Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this special episode of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, recorded in front of a live audience at Bath Festival. I'm Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, and along with Thea Lenarducci, a commissioning editor at the TLS and the regular co-host of this podcast, we were delighted to be joined at Bath by Robert Webb and Margaret Drabble. Robert Webb is an actor, a comedian and a writer. You'll probably know him as one half of the comedy partnership Mitchell and Webb. He was in the series Peep Show for over 10 years, and he played Bertie Wooster in the West End to great acclaim. Last year, he published the wonderful and enjoyable How Not to Be a Boy, which manages the very difficult balance of being both very funny and also extremely serious. It's part memoir about family life growing up in a small town in Lincolnshire, and part discourse or argument about expectations of masculinity and the damage they can do. He's now working on his first novel. Margaret Drabble also started out as an actor and then became a writer, but she started writing earlier in her career. Her first novel was published in 1963, but she has said that it was only by the time she got to her sixth, The Needle's Eye, that she felt like she could do what she wanted with form and plot and narrative voice. She has a damehood and a CBE, and her fascinating, absorbing and insightful work includes a memoir, short stories, literary studies and 19 novels, of which the most recent is The Dark Flood Rises. Thea began by talking about the family and the family's role in shaping the individual, and by asking Margaret, who has written in both genres, what determines her choice of form and how differently she experienced the writing of a memoir versus the writing of a novel.
It's made for me in that there are certain kinds of memoir I cannot write and will never be able to write. There are subjects I could never touch in my family. So I fictionalise those parts, and the only memoir I've written has been quite evasive and about a largely about a member of my family with whom I had no problems, and there's only one of them, so you know, it was a rather restricted palette, really, and this was my auntie.
Right.
So that was a memoir about your auntie, as compared to The Peppered Moth, which was a fictional account of your mother, and it stayed very close to the truth for at least part of the novel, didn't it?
You're quite right. I'd completely forgotten The Peppered Moth, which was about my mother, and caused some upset within the family because they felt I hadn't got a right to write about my mother, although she was dead. And I did have quite... My mother was a difficult woman. I didn't have a difficult relationship with her. I had a kind of quite straightforward relationship with her. But she was difficult and she was unhappy. And I think I wanted to write the book to make myself feel better about her life. But in fact, it didn't really work. I went on feeling rather unhappy about her life. So the experiment of it... I understood better why she felt so unhappy, because going back into her childhood, her Yorkshire childhood, the struggle she'd had to confront adult life, her depressions, her dissatisfactions, I was able to place her in a generational context by writing about her. But she still remained very problematic, although dead.
Can I quote a little bit of something from The Peppered Moth back at you? Sorry, just a little tiny bit. That you say at one point, if this story were merely a fiction, it would be possible to fill in these gaps with plausible incidents. But the narrator here has to admit to considerable difficulty, indeed to failure. I have tried, and I apologise for that intrusive authorial eye, which I have done my best to avoid. And I was wondering why you felt you had to apologise for the authorial eye, and why were you trying so hard to avoid it?
Is that from the epilogue? I can't remember where that bit came from.
I think it's when you're talking about their marriage.
The marriage.
Yeah, why
my parents got married.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, well, I suppose I wanted to put my cards on the table because it was going to be obvious to any reader who knew anything about my life story that this was my mother and my father. And I hadn't been able to write a memoir about them. Mm. I couldn't have written about them as they were, but I left enough of them in, and I had to say that it wasn't the entire truth, that I'd invented bits. But I did quote things that really happened. I mean, my father's politics are there, and I did publish in full my mother's manifesto to the women of Sheffield when my father stood in the 1945 election for the Labour Party. And I published her manifesto, which I found when she died. And it was women of Sheffield, this is what we're fighting for in the post-war years. And it was rather affecting. So I kind of wanted to say that some of it's true and some of it isn't.
So you wanted to signal that very clearly.
I wanted to signal that I hadn't made everything up, but there were some things that my imagination couldn't enter into.
Yeah, sure. Robert, I was interested as well that you also address your reader actually very directly. You kind of explain things, and sometimes you apologise, and sometimes you tell the reader what to do. You say, come here, or go over there, or, you know, look at this. And I was wondering why you chose to be so direct.
I suppose I just wanted to, because it's a memoir, and it's a single-volume memoir, so the last thing I wanted to hear was that it shows promise. I was only going to do this once, and I suppose I wanted to take the opportunity to sort of write how I talk and to make it a very accessible and intimate book, because I was talking about something that some of the readers, male readers in particular, I worried that they were going to find it challenging, because I'm talking about masculinity and how it can be harmful, and some men sometimes experience that as an attack on their character rather than something that we've all been sort of conditioned to perform. So my two ace cards were humour and mm-hmm. trying to make them laugh and get under the radar there,
yeah.
and intimacy, just by sort of, you know, pulling my trousers down first and daring them to laugh, and finding that in general, because I've been hearing from men and women who've read the book that actually they haven't laughed and they've gone, yes, of course, we've all got a charming birthmark in the shape of Portugal or whatever it is, so metaphorically or literally. So yes, it felt like I'm only going to do this sort of first person, this is me thing once, and so let's just relax and just take the reader along with me.
And did you think about who that reader was when you're saying you?
No, not really. I
mean, you weren't talking to.
In my vast experience of writing a whole book, I'll be giving Margaret some tips later. it was, I suppose, I write to please myself. It was really, I just wanted those sentences to go click in a way that I liked. In various points of different parts of the book, I suppose I was thinking of the living people who were in it and what they were going to make of it. Of course I was. And I ended up sending early drafts to all of the significant living people in the book. I didn't give them a veto, but I did, because I thought that would melt their brains, but I did invite comments, and thank goodness they all came back with a double thumbs up.
Yeah.
If they'd had objections, I don't know what I'd have done.
Well, I mean, and that's the point, because both The Peppered Moth and How Not to Be a Boy, the towering parental figures in both of those books were dead before you you created the work. Presumably that's very significant. Was the writing, did you experience it as a sort of expurgation, or was it cathartic for you?
Well, I mean, my mother died 28 years ago, so I've had that long to get used to the idea, so I didn't worry about her so much, if that makes any sense, and I don't have any faith in the afterlife, so, even if there were such a thing, I'm surely they've got better things to do than to take umbrage and how I portrayed them in a memoir. My father died in 2013, which is much more recent, and the honest response is I couldn't possibly have written the book while he was still around, because he was not at his best in the 1970s when he had this young family that he didn't quite know what to do with, and my mother divorced him when I was five, and so I have to sort of start at the beginning in that respect. I couldn't really miss that out. Later I get to be generous about him and say all the things that I admired about him, but I had to kind of include that bit, and it would have been just too mean to do that while he was around. So it's not that I was drumming my fingers waiting, but he'd already died before I had the idea for how to approach the book.
Mm. Margaret, can I just pick up on that? You said that you you wrote about your mother particularly and thought it would help. In fact, you say this in Pattern in the Carpet, don't you? You specifically say, I wrote about her and I thought it would help, and it didn't help, actually. I thought I would feel better about it, and I don't. So you write about your auntie Phil in the Pattern in the Carpet, because that's a much more straightforward relationship, a happier relationship.
She'd had a better life.
Uh-huh. And did you feel that that was more successful in terms of the writing, in terms of the work?
No, it's a much less ambitious book, really. I mean, it's a sort of jigsaw of a book. It's just bits and pieces. It's a completely freestyle, weird kind of memoir, which started off as a history of the jigsaw puzzle, but my editor didn't seem to think that was all that interesting, which I thought was riveting. But I wish I'd stuck to the original plan, in a way. But a good friend of mine, hearing me talk about it, said, really, you're trying to write about your aunt. And I did realise that through writing about my aunt, I could say the nicer things I had to say about other bits of the family. But you used the word cathartic when asking Robert about his book, and it wasn't really cathartic. I mean, I think writing The Pattern in the Carpet made me smile, and I know I think my family liked it better than The Peppered Moth for obvious reasons.
There's a real concern in a lot of your work, Margaret, with genealogy. And in fact, in Pure Gold Baby, Jess, the character, is, I think she's involved in a study of local DNA, and there's an especial focus on matrilineal passage of traits, on that relationship between mothers and daughters and grandmothers in your work.
My mitochondrial DNA, I think, is what I went into, which is the story of the peppered moth and evolution and carrying on the female traits. Yes, I was very worried about transmitting bad characteristics through my family, and having inherited some. So I find the whole genetic question. I used to believe when I was young that nature was a blank sheet and that each baby was itself and nurture was all. And of course, as you watch the child grow, you realize that nature plays a far greater part than you thought it did, for good and for bad.
No, Robert, there's a fear with you as well, at least initially, until you sort of make your peace with the role of your father. the focus being more on the patrilineal traits, obviously. And what Margaret was just saying now about you don't realise quite how soon things start to shape the individual. You talk about it quite petrifyingly, how it happens in the womb already before the baby has even been born.
Yes, I mean, it's not a social science book with 30 pages of notes in the back, but I do quote scientists every now and again, and Lise Elliott and Cordelia Fine, I think it's in Pink Brain, Blue Brain, where she's talking about how mothers tend to lower their voice when they know the sex of the child, when they know the sex of the fetus is male, they take more time and they lower their voice slightly, and also when the child is born, the parents are more likely to express pride if it's a boy or happiness if it's a girl. Fathers look forward to meeting their children for gendered reasons. If it's a boy, they're going to bond over sports, and mothers think they're going to have a terrific relationship with daughters, some hope. So this is all sort of going on before the child is born.
Could I just say that when we were expecting our babies, we didn't know the gender.
Of course.
So there could be no pre-gender expectation, because we never had a scan. The baby popped out, and I guessed the sex of each of mine wrong. But that was fine. But it can't have had prenatal impressions, because I didn't know what it was.
And did you really have no idea at all? Because, you know, there are so many old wives' tales about, if you've got a lot of morning sickness,
they're
it's most
wrong,
likely
though.
To be... Yeah, they are always wrong, I suppose.
I expected to have girls because we were... I was one of three sisters, and my brother was so much later that boys were sort of an afterthought in our family. Women were what we had. So I was astonished to have a boy first.
Yeah. But so, Robert, do you think there's now more conditioning rather than less? Because now you can start, you could know pretty early on.
I wasn't trying to make the point that conditioning starts there, but just that these are unconscious things that parents are doing without necessarily noticing.
Yes, yeah. So it could be...
I'm not sure that it's actually going to affect the baby. I mean, of course, we don't know, because there's no control experiment. You can't put a male infant and a female infant in a controlled, safe, isolated environment and see what they do differently before they go spare. That would be unethical, to put it mildly.
I think so, yeah.
But there is some evidence that, I mean, I'm slightly straying out of my realm of expertise here, but I believe there's evidence that when it comes to nature versus nurture, it's something of a red herring because the environment affects the way the brain develops. So it's those pathways are rooted in response to what the child hears and does and repeats and learns. So it's not just... nurture is doing some of the naturing, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I mean it shapes, in fact, in some way shapes the brain.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I would like to talk about anger, if that's all right.
Right.
I've got anger written down here a lot without making anyone too cross. It seems to me there's quite a lot of anger in both of your books. Robert, you write about how anger sometimes seems like the only emotion that boys, and indeed men, are allowed or encouraged to express. So grief or confusion or frustration often come out as anger. Is that...
Yes, I mean, a lot of the book, you know, the sort of rules that as I understood them of how to be a boy, that boys are supposed to be disruptive and boisterous and noisy, and they would rather do maths than reading, and they're running and jumping and swimming and climbing trees, and I couldn't really do any of that, and so I found it quite a tight fit, and I can play most of that for laughs in the early chapters, but there is a serious side, I think, which is the stuff about emotional repression, basically, that telling boys to man up and boys don't cry and shrug it off and turn it off and ignore it and all of these unwanted emotions. And it does have to come out somewhere, and it often comes out as anger. So, I mean, the way the book works really is that I speak for myself, but I'm hoping to ring some bells. I still get angry when what I'm actually feeling is fear, or angry when what I'm feeling is grief, or angry when I'm embarrassed. And I think that starts in childhood, because boys are... You don't develop those skills to become your own emotional detective and to work out why you're feeling what you're feeling.
Mm. And does that ring a bell with you, Margaret, then, as a writer and observer and mother of two sons? There's a line in the Millstone where the character's sister, they're exchanging letters, and one sister says to the other, who is expecting a child, says, "Oh yes, my son Nicholas, he's just reached that violent age, that phase that is inescapable to all boys."
Yes, I was very interested in Robert's take on anger. There is a moment where you actually hit somebody in the book.
I nearly hit somebody who's insulted my girlfriend.
He was insulted, yes. But you didn't actually make contact.
No, because I had
a bigger
friend who got in front of me. Yes.
Yes, that's right.
Fortunately for his face and my puny wrist.
Yeah. No, I mean, anger is something that I try not to feel because it's upsetting, and I do find myself in my dreams. I'm embarrassed sometimes to find myself getting extremely angry with people. And I wake up and I'm embarrassed by the anger and the way I've shouted back at people, because I tend to repress it in life, perhaps overly.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It seems to me that in your books, it's the women who are experiencing a lot of anger, but they are experiencing it quietly. They're not letting it out. There's a moment in the short story, The Day in the Life of the Smiling Woman,
yeah.
And she smiles all the way through, and she's very successful and very busy and self-sacrificing. And at one point, her husband is being particularly horrible to her, and she just screams at him. And that's like a kind of click. And after that, things don't make so much sense to her. Her relationships don't make so much sense. Yeah. In a way, because she's... Is that because she's let their anger out? Is it? Is that?
Yes, yes, that was my Doris Lessing phase, I think, when I was full of angry women. But it's also true that in The Millstone, the pivotal scene in The Millstone, as many read it, is when Rosamund screams in the hospital. Mm. Yeah. And that is anger, and I am capable of that kind of anger. But again, it was on behalf of your girlfriend. I could do it on behalf of my children in a way that I found it very hard to do on my own behalf.
Right.
Which is the same with the character Rosamund in The Millstone, because her anger is a generative anger. Yeah. She loses her temper and she
on purpose.
On purpose, and that enables her to see her child and who is in hospital. I wonder, though, talking about The Millstone and indeed much of your earlier work, if the more kind of central emotion or guiding emotion for these characters is in fact fear. There's a lot of fear, a fear of inconveniencing, of behaving how one oughtn't to behave, of upsetting the status quo.
Yes. If we're talking about gender, I think women are very compliant. They try very hard to be compliant and not to cause offence. So I think there is a lot of that in my work. Of women, but on the other hand, there's also some quite forceful people as well. I mean, I had to reread The Millstone the other day for some radio program, and what I really thought I discerned in it that I hadn't discerned so strongly is what the women fear is rejection. That's why they're inhibited. That's why they can't say they love somebody. That they're afraid of rejection, and I think that's an undercurrent in my work of women who are quite brave on some levels, but they're afraid of being rejected on others. And that's just how many women of my generation are.
You talk about Rosamund in The Millstone, her sort of her bouncing back and forth between cowardice and confidence.
Yes.
Presumably that's the same for what you describe, Robert. You've been both insecure and extremely confident.
Yes, I think sometimes that kind of, particularly when I'm talking about when I was a student, I was using a certain arrogance. It came out as arrogance, really, as a sort of self-protective thing, and what I fondly imagined to be my talent as a comedy actor. And I thought I was pretty good, and I'd deliberately gone there to find out if I was good enough to be in Footlights, and they decided yes I was, and I was unbearable for a while because by my third year I was terribly grand, and for a clown this is a ridiculous look. I mean, once you're on stage you just fall over and you do stupid voices and you do Footlightsy wordplay sketches, but the rest of the time I was sort of swatting around Empress of all I surveyed, and it was definitely a self-defense mechanism.
Mm. There's another, I don't know if emotion is the right word, that I want to ask you about, Margaret, in your books, which I find very, it's an unusual topic, and it's boredom, and the fear of boredom. Oh. It comes, I was striking a nerve here. I was struck by something in The Ice Age, I was reading The Ice Age, and Anthony Keating, he's remembering that there's a time when they're on holiday, and he gets stuck in the loo, and the rest of his family is, I think, down at the beach.
Yeah.
His boredom escalates so quickly that pretty soon he thinks, oh, well, if I'm here for too long, I can just hang myself with my belt. When I was reading it back, it felt very funny, but the first time it's really serious. He means it. He's so frightened of the awful boredom that he really thinks about that. And you have talked about that in other of your works.
Boredom is a terrifying emotion, and it can creep over me so quickly, rather like Anthony stuck in the lavatory.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to die of boredom right now at this bus stop. I'm going to die because I'm waiting for the bus and it's not going to come. But my father, interestingly, he had a very difficult sort of way. He sort of started life not being allowed to go to university, having to go to night school, and finally, he started as a travelling salesman. And he said he was so bored. And I think of his early years when he had no prospects and he was really bored. And I think he admitted to being bored. Really, adolescents and people in their 20s are often very bored. It's not a very respectable emotion. There's a line of poetry by Berryman, I think, which says, "Life, my friends, is deeply boring, only we must not say so."
Well, exactly. That's why it's so unusual that you talk about it, because it's not... Mm. It's not. It's kind of not okay to it's say, oh, God, I can't bear this, or I can't bear the
There's
boredom.
That saying, isn't there, that only boring people are bored?
Exactly. Which,
it's, just it's, quite, it's a taboo.
It becomes an indictment on the person.
Yeah. So you don't say it because it means that you yourself
that means you've,
are not,
you've failed
you don't
to
have
think
enough
of something fascinating.
I
remember seeing a 90-year-old lady with my husband, and he was interviewing her about something, on and on, she mentioned, I've never been bored for a moment in my life. And Michael said, for sure she knows how to bore other people. I felt that there was a lot of truth in that.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, the fear of being boring. Yeah. That was the kind of, you know, the worst, that I was scared of being accused of being boring. I thought that was like the worst.
So you kind of went out of
but
your
I,
way.
But also I thought that being boring was when you have not enough to say, because I was very shy as a child and I worried that I'm just socially awkward and wouldn't be able to hold my own in a conversation, whereas actually the really boring people are the people who don't shut up.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. I mean, some people, you know, Brian Blessed, he's welcome to talk and talk. But you know.
But I wondered if either of you actually at any point had ever found it, because you both also talk about life in a small town, sometimes in a small town in Lincolnshire, in fact,
yes,
both of you.
Indeed.
I wondered if you ever found that, the boredom that can be experienced there, to be creative or galvanising or energising or just boring.
I think there's probably something to be said for leaning back on your chair and staring out of the window if you're a writer and not to have too much stimulation, but then I enjoy not having too much stimulation. I think at heart I'm bone idle, and I've managed to do what I've done because I'm scared of that. I know left to my own devices I just do nothing. So yes, I think there's something to be said for keeping your mind fallow for the occasional period, I suppose. Again, in my huge experience.
Again, both of you in your work, and again, if we could start with you, Margaret, because you, while tackling the family, you progressively through the years, your novels seem to have opened out more and become increasingly sociologically minded. Mm-hmm. I wondered whether that was a conscious choice to sort of open it out and broaden it into a kind of a bigger work in that sense. Or, I mean, what brought that about? I mean, I was sort of thinking about the sort of the 70s when that sort of started and consecutive conservative governments, with it some kind of reaction against that idea of there being no society, although Margaret Thatcher's famous comment didn't come till 87, I think. But
I think what happened was that when I started to write, I was really quite housebound. I mean, I was a typical housebound housewife with three small children. And so I wrote about what was there. I wrote about that experience, which resonated with many, many women. There are many educated women like me who found themselves with narrowed horizons rather than broader horizons. But then, as the children grew older and started to go to school and then just grew up generally, I was able to engage with a wider social sort of range of subjects. And what frustrates me now is that I'm fascinated by the banking crash and by Brexit, but I just feel I haven't got enough leg force to go and pursue the topics that I used to have in the 70s and 80s. So I feel these subjects, although I would like to tackle them, I haven't got the physical energy to pursue them. So in a way, my canvas has shrunk again.
Well,
it's gone back to the domestic.
You continue, certainly in The Dark Flood Rises, you continue to pursue housing.
I'm fascinated by housing, it's true. The Dark Flood Rises is a social novel, but it's about the sociology of ageing, really, which is, I have to say, a narrowing and eventually terminal topic.
Robert, you talking about time and place, or specifically place at this point, back in Lincolnshire. One of the most striking things that I found in reading the book is, and it's so obvious when you point it out, is how early homophobia comes into it. How homophobia in 1980s Lincolnshire, it's all but automatic. It's almost like a necessary tool for survival.
Yes. No, it was made very clear to me that, you know, if there was one thing worse than being a girl, it was being gay, and that only gay boys talk to girls. I mean, you have to be gay to want to hang out with girls, surely. So that,
which doesn't
that was
make
made,
much sense when you examine
some,
it more closely.
Something of a paradox, yes. but that was those seem to be the rules. I mean, I'd like to think that things have improved. It's a difficult thing to measure, isn't it? There are a couple of teachers, primary school teachers, in my wife Abby's family, and they report that playground homophobia has not gone away. And it's you know, it's still there, but I think in the culture has moved on so much. And you know, gay marriage, when I was growing up in the 80s, the idea that two men could get married was just from Mars. It was a completely crazy idea. So I think things have changed very quickly quite recently, but in terms of, you know, how you perform being a boy, I think that is still there.
And Margaret, do you think you've seen that change? Obviously, you've seen that social conditions change and attitudes, or do you think not that much?
I think things have changed enormously. I mean, I entirely agree that one would never have foreseen gay acceptance in the United States as well. I mean, it's just astonishing how things have moved. But of course, I don't know what the playground life is like now, because I don't know any. I mean, even my grandchildren are way beyond the playground, so I don't really know what's going on. But I would suspect that Robert is quite right when he says that these attitudes persist in many, many children, and that sort of little insults are flung around exactly as they were when we were children. Mm. I'm sure that's true.
Do you think it might be possible that it also depends where you are? I don't know whether it's different in the big cities, or I mean, as well as time shaping attitudes, that whether place will shape them as well.
It may well do. You know, there might be, you know, an inner city school compared to a private school in home counties compared to a normal school. I don't know. I'm guessing, but I would imagine that plays a part. Yes.
And I think teachers are probably more helpful now, because I mean, all this thing about educating people to be aware, it often sounds ridiculous, but there probably is some value in that, and in getting teachers to look out for certain things that could go wrong, which certainly wouldn't have been true when we were young. I mean, nobody paid any attention at all.
They'd have joined in,
exactly. So thing, on that level, things have improved.
You've been listening to an edited version of a TLS event recorded in front of a live audience at Bath Festival, with Margaret Drabble and Robert Webb talking to me, Lucy Dallas, and Thea Lenarduzzi. Many, many thanks to them and to the audience for joining us. For next week's podcast, Stig and Thea will be back in the studio discussing Philip Roth and his legacy, and talking to the Man Booker International winner, Olga Tokarczuk. We'll be sharing more events like this one in the next month or so. Next we'll be at Hay Festival, speaking to the novelist Ian McEwan, the historian Simon Sharma, the playwright and novelist Barney Norris, and the novelist Emma Healy. So do keep checking your podcast feed. This week's issue of the TLS is a philosophy special, with articles on why empathy cuts across species, the limited ambitions of ethical thinking, and why dignity matters, as well as the usual reviews of the most important books and exhibitions, plus an unsettling new short story from the excellent Samantha Schweblin. For now, though, from Thea and from me, goodbye.